Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, reaction to sanctions imposed on Iran.
Some analysts are saying that the reason for the new sanctions appears to be in part to allay these fears that Iran will grow so strong and powerful that as a rival to Gulf countries, it will become more of a threat.
The U.S. Supreme Court agrees to consider a controversial immigration case. And we'll look at the contributions of musician Glenn Frey of the Eagles. It's right here on The Voice of America. Iran's defense minister says new U.S. sanctions targeting the country's ballistic missile program will have no effect on missile development. The U.S. imposed the measures against five Iranian nationals and a network of companies with links to banned missile activity, a move that followed the lifting of economic sanctions tied to Iran's nuclear program. Iran drew condemnation from the United States and other Western powers for two ballistic missile tests late last year, said to violate U.N. Security Council resolutions. Iran defended the tests as a matter of national security. Correspondent Heather Murdoch is following this story from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo, and she joins us on the line. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you.
So, Heather, what is the reaction to the new sanctions against Iran?
The reaction to the new sanctions against Iran from the Iranian side has been very negative. Iranian officials have called the new sanctions illegitimate, both morally and legally, and they also say that the new sanctions won't, in fact, actually slow down their ballistic missile program at all.
Is there a feeling that these new sanctions may not be enough to quell fears among Gulf nations?
I think so. Some analysts are saying that the reason for the new sanctions appears to be in part to allay these fears that Iran will grow so strong and powerful that as a rival to Gulf countries, it will become more of a threat. Some analysts are saying that these new sanctions are just simply not enough because they only target a very small group of companies and individuals.
What is the fear about Iran getting more strength in the region?
Well, right now, this region is incredibly polarized between support for Sunni-dominated Saudi Arabia and Iran, which is predominantly Shia. And countries are lining up behind them. They're fighting two proxy wars in Yemen and in Syria, and they have recently cut diplomatic ties between Saudi and Iran, and several countries on the Saudi side, other Gulf countries, have followed suit. So obviously the great giant fear is these two large countries going to war. It's such a horrible idea, people are not even saying it's a possibility. However, as tensions between these countries continue and continue to deepen, the wars that they are fighting via proxy are also deepening. So there's no end in sight in Syria or Yemen unless these two countries can at least deal with each other.
Well, are there any moves to get these two countries to iron out their differences?
Well, there are various countries have offered to mediate, and the Pakistani prime minister was in Saudi Arabia recently to attempt to mediate. But so far, there hasn't been much progress that's been seen publicly.
Well, let me ask you this, Heather. What was the reaction to the lifting of economic sanctions tied to Iran's nuclear program?
The reaction to the lifting of sanctions is actually depends entirely on which side you're on. The reaction from the people that support Iran was very positive. People are looking at Iran moving into the world economy and the banking sectors, oil sectors, and also a new era of diplomacy. Iran has been isolated from the international community for a long time, and this kind of diplomacy that's happening along not just the sanctions, but along with the sanctions, like the release of the American prisoners from Iran, the quick resolution to the American sailors that were arrested in Iran recently. All of these things point to more peaceful relations between Iran and the West. On the other hand, Iran's rivals, Saudi Arabia and its supporters, while they have been very quiet, we haven't heard much directly, analysts say they are very unhappy and very worried that a strong Iran will become a more militarized Iran and will threaten them.
Well, thank you very much, Heather, for speaking with us from Cairo today.
Thank you.
For a look at what's going on the web is my colleague, Sarah Williams, and she joins me right here at the anchor desk. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you, Susan. Well, there's been wide reaction to the dropping of some U.S. and international sanctions against Iran. The Los Angeles Times reports that the U.S. and Iran remain worlds apart on major foreign policy issues, and it says that chasm will not be bridged easily. It notes that the first test will come when world powers are scheduled to resume talks later this month, designed to end the war in Syria. Iran backs the government of Syrian President Bashar Assad, which goes directly against the U.S., most of the West, and Saudi Arabia. The Economist reports that U.S. President Barack Obama is justified in hailing the Iran deal as a diplomatic triumph, but it says the agreement supporters need to be realistic about it. It notes that Iran's recent behavior does not demonstrate any substantive change. The Economist calls Tehran to task for executing gay people, locking up dissidents, and stoking sectarian conflict around the Middle East. Meanwhile, the Associated Press reports that the head of Iran's central bank says it has transferred some of its formerly frozen assets to ensure that financial sanctions have been fully lifted. Viola Saif said on Iranian state television that the deal gives Tehran access to $32 billion in overseas assets. Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, said Tuesday that Iran should increase efforts to attract foreign investment and liberalize its economy. Well, in other social media news, there is the hashtag Twitter Down. That's received more than 136,000 tweets. That's because Twitter was not working for a good portion of Tuesday. Gregory Pizarro tweeted, "With Twitter down, I spent a few hours doing work. My job seems important." Thames Teachers wrote, "Twitter is down and I can't tweet about it." And Tossed tweets, "What we want to know is how Twitter down is top trending when Twitter has been down." Hashtag conspiracy theory. The Huffington Post wrote, "Twitter went down across the world early Tuesday morning, and the internet seriously freaked out. The cause of the outage was not immediately known, but users soon switched to Instagram and Facebook to vent their frustrations." Susan?
Well, thank you very much, Sarah. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Do you sleep poorly during the work week, but try to make up for it by sleeping in on weekends? A new study from researchers at the University of Chicago finds that having two consecutive nights of sleep, as many do on weekends, has been shown to offset an increased risk of diabetes, which has been associated with a lack of sleep during the work week. Scientists say that getting less sleep, such as 4 or 5 hours a night, even temporarily, can increase the odds of developing diabetes by about 16%, which is about the same increased risk factor for those who are obese. While their work focused on sleep and an increased risk of diabetes, the researchers say further study needs to be conducted regarding other negative health effects of sleep deprivation, such as high blood pressure and various cognitive difficulties. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The United Nations has indicated it cannot issue invitations to Syrian peace talks scheduled to take place next Monday until there is consensus among members of the International Syria Support Group on which opposition representatives can engage on the country's future with the government. Farhan Haq is a spokesman for UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
At this stage, the UN will proceed with issuing invitations when the countries spearheading the International Syria Support Group process come to an understanding on who among the opposition should be invited. The Secretary General urges those countries to redouble efforts to reach that agreement. Right now, the objective is and remains to get the parties to talks in Geneva by the date of the 25th of January. At the same time, of course, there are concerns about the arrangements. He is, as we speak, in touch with the members of the Security Council. And so we will have to see whether the various parties, the members of the Security Council, whether we can all come to an agreement on the best way forward. If we need to alter our timetable one way or another, we'll let you know. But right now, our target remains as it was.
17 world powers plan to be at the Geneva talks, including the United States, Russia, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, who hold different views on the country's future, including the fate of President Bashar al-Assad. The talks are aimed at setting up a transitional government. In an interview on CNN, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said the Geneva conference is the only way to get a political settlement. Syria analyst David Lesh of Trinity College in Texas tells VOA's Victor Beatty deciding who will represent the opposition in Geneva was always, in his mind, one of the biggest challenges to ending the five-year civil war that has killed at least 250,000 people and displaced millions.
There's just too many disparate groups backed by different regional and international players that have different agendas. And this has been one of the Achilles heels of the Syrian opposition since the beginning of the uprising. There's many different fault lines. You have differences from the beginning that have been papered over somewhat between political opposition, most of them outside of Syria, and the armed opposition inside of Syria, armed opposition, non-ISIS or non-Jabhat al-Nusra, which all sides are excluding from the talks. And then, of course, you have Russia and Iran pushing for some groups, particularly Russia, who pushing for some opposition groups that many in other elements of the Syrian opposition, backed by the Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks, among others, accused of being collaborators with the regime, because from the beginning, they've called for a dialogue and a political resolution rather than the armed opposition. So there's many different fault lines. Of course, the breach in relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran haven't helped matters at all. And then, of course, you have the death of Zahran Alush, who is the head of one of the leading armed opposition groups, the Jaish al-Islam, the Army of Islam, back in December. And he was one of the few leading armed opposition elements, leading figures who attended the conference in Saudi Arabia and was willing to play a role in the makeup of the Syrian opposition council that would meet theoretically with the Syrian government representatives in Geneva on January 25th. So these are, many, many obstacles to overcome. I'd be very, very surprised if that January 25th meeting is held. They're already talking about delays.
Is this issue insurmountable in your view?
It's not insurmountable. It's just finding the right moment. Sometimes the right moment will take the realization of a stalemate on the battlefront, which has occurred from time to time. But recently, we've had some fluctuations with the Russian intervention. The Syrian government forces have made some gains. They've also experienced some losses recently or setbacks against the Islamic State. And also trying to find a point when the regional players on opposing sides, the international players on opposing sides are all on the same page. And that's very, very hard to do. The main objective right now is just to keep the Vienna process going, if in name only, just so there's not the appearance of a diplomatic setback.
UN diplomats meeting with Syria envoy Stefan de Mistura Monday in a closed-door session said he told them additional work needs to be done, but no new date for the Geneva talks was considered. Russian Ambassador Vitaly Churkin said the opposition delegation must be comprehensive, adding if some well-known opposition leaders are not invited, it's going to make the delegation less inclusive. Coming up on International Edition, the highest U.S. court takes on an immigration debate and a look at the music of Glenn Frey. The U.S. Supreme Court has announced that it will hear a case challenging President Obama's plan to protect more than 4 million immigrants from deportation. Correspondent Carolyn Pursuti is following that story and joins us now with details. Welcome, Carolyn.
Thank you, Susan. Good to be here.
Thank you. What can you tell us about this?
Well, basically, the Supreme Court has decided to hear a challenge to President Obama's executive order to shield more than 4 million immigrants from deportation. Now, these would be immigrants who have U.S.-born children, which make the children American citizens.
What is the president's argument for doing this?
The president's argument is that these are not criminals. These are not the administration's priority for deportation. These are people who could be paying taxes. As long as they have a work permit, as long as they are working, then they can contribute to the nation's economy.
And those who are opposed to it?
Those who are opposed to it say, we are just encouraging other people to enter the United States illegally and continue to stay here, and then we are rewarding them. So that's basically the argument of the Federation for Immigration Reform, the organization known as FAIR.
Nothing happens quickly at the Supreme Court. This could drag on for quite a while.
Absolutely. We aren't expecting the arguments to be heard before the Supreme Court until April, and then a decision won't be made until June.
But this will be a case that's closely watched by many people.
Absolutely, because this will not only affect the 2016 presidential election, but also the president's legacy. He stepped out on a limb, if you will, by making these executive orders, these executive actions, and certainly this was one of the more far-reaching executive orders that he has done. And the fact that the Supreme Court will be making a decision in June clears the way for a decision to be made while the president is in office. Should they rule in favor of the president's deferral program, then these immigrants can stay in this country. Should they rule against it, immediately they would be sent back to their country.
Well, thank you very much, Carolyn.
Thank you, Susan.
This is VOA.
Green Beat, for a healthier planet.
Residential homes are estimated to be responsible for about a third of the United Kingdom's greenhouse gas emissions. But researchers at Cardiff University hope to change that with what they consider to be a blueprint for a positive energy home, one that gives back more energy than it uses.
The innovation is combining the renewable energy supply, storage, and demand technologies together.
Jo Patterson is project leader on the Sulzer House at the Welch School of Architecture. She says most of the technologies are widely available to consumers. The home is built with high levels of insulation for low air leakage and solar panels on its roof. Here's Sulzer House architect Esther Como.
The photovoltaic panels transform the radiation energy from the sun, and they convert this energy into electricity.
With a construction price of around $190,000, researchers also tried to make the three-bedroom house affordable and attractive to a typical home buyer. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
Musician and songwriter Glenn Frey, a founding member of the Eagles, one of the most popular pop rock groups in U.S. history, has died at the age of 67. A statement released by the band said Frey died Monday in New York from complications related to rheumatoid arthritis, colitis, and pneumonia, illnesses they say he had been battling for weeks. Well, joining me here in the studio to talk about his music is Larry London, host of Border Crossings. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you, Susan. The music industry suffers yet another loss. It's been a very difficult start to 2016. Of course, Natalie Cole passed away. Recently, it was David Bowie. And now you can add to the list Glenn Frey, who did, in fact, start the Eagles. And at the time, he and Don Henley were backup singers for Linda Ronstadt. That's where they started together back in the 60s. And now here we are 45 years after the Eagles first began, and we've lost another music pioneer.
And he is really credited with starting what they called country rock. Maybe you could describe that for us.
Well, it's a combination of folk and rock. So a lot of artists these days do crossover music and make the crossover successfully, Taylor Swift most notably. But Glenn Frey was doing it long, long before Taylor Swift was even born. And so people like good music. And in the United States, in radio, we like to give music a label. But good music is good music, whether it's country or rock or country rock. Good music is good music. Glenn Frey, along with Don Henley and without Don Henley, wrote so many great songs. In fact, Glenn Frey wrote Hotel California, which we all know to be sung by Don Henley. But Glenn wrote that song along with many, many other Eagles hits.
Like, for instance?
Tequila Sunrise, The Heat Is On, which was his own solo hit, Take It Easy, Peaceful Easy Feeling. These are all songs that Glenn Frey wrote along with Don Henley.
'Cause I got a peaceful, easy feeling, and I know you won't let me down, 'cause I'm all
that was the drummer in his band, and they met by coincidence at one point, and they just hit it off, and they took off.
That's right, and Don Henley issued a statement today that he's lost a brother. And despite all the difficulties that the Eagles faced, and they did have their share of challenges over the years, they were always brothers and remain brothers, and he's got a gaping void in his life now left by somebody that he loved dearly.
The band split up for a while. And then they came back together, and then they kept going strong again. What was it, 14 years they were apart?
That's right. They took a 14-year break, a much-needed break, and they went in different solo directions for a while. they reunited and remained on tour until just this last July. And in fact, from what I understand, the Eagles were supposed to be inducted into the Kennedy Center Honors. They decided to postpone that because Glenn Frey was undergoing surgery for his colitis that he was suffering from. And so, unfortunately, he didn't live to see that honor.
Well, you're probably too young, Larry, but I'm not.
Probably.
I remember when this was a big band. Some people say it was the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and the Eagles. Do you remember them at all in elementary school? I guess that's when you were.
Come on now, Susan. I appreciate the kind words, but yes, I recall being on the radio in Detroit back in the 70s. I started in radio in 75, and I was on the air in Detroit in 79, right when the Eagles were at their height of popularity. And I remember them releasing The Long Run and some of the other popular music that they put out back there in the late 70s and throughout the 80s as well. And, it's a page from the songbook of my life.
Yes.
And I'm sure it is from yours as
well.
Yes,
it is.
It's always sad when the music business loses another pioneer.
Well, thank you, Larry, for stopping by.
Thank you, Susan.
Don't let the sound of your own wheels make you crazy. Come on, babe, don't say nay. I gotta know if your sweet love is gonna save me.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Trafficking in persons or modern slavery is a global multi-billion dollar criminal enterprise. It destabilizes governments and feeds the corruption that compromises the ability of nations to prosper. It fuels other criminal activities such as trafficking or illicit drugs and gun smuggling. It is one of the means by which terrorists fund their activities. Today, it is estimated that there are more than 20 million victims of trafficking globally. No country in the world is immune from this blight on humanity. The United States is one of the top destination countries for human trafficking, as well as for goods produced using forced labor. This means that if we are to fight this scourge, we must begin at home. 3 years ago, President Barack Obama took a number of steps to strengthen and unify the U.S. government response to modern slavery, beginning with a focus on four priority areas: rule of law, that is, investigation, arrest, and prosecution of traffickers; victim assistance, such as health and trauma services; child welfare, ensuring that no forced labor was used anywhere along the supply chain in the production and delivery of goods and services purchased by the United States government; and public awareness and outreach, making the public aware of the scope and extent of the problem, and training people within the government and the public at large how to identify victims of trafficking. Part of this awareness campaign is the President's annual proclamation of January as National Slavery and Human Trafficking Prevention Month. Our intelligence teams have devoted more resources to identifying trafficking networks, law enforcement officers have been working to dismantle those networks, and prosecutors have striven to punish traffickers, said President Obama in this year's proclamation. We have also enhanced our domestic protection so foreign-born workers better understand their rights. To address the underlying conditions that enable human trafficking in the first place, the United States is promoting development and economic growth across the globe, said President Obama. As we work to end human trafficking here in the United States, we will continue to lead the effort to root it out around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.